everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. Hey, we've got the roundtable back. Wade McFaul. I started to say McFaul, and then I stopped myself because I'm so confused. Is it McFaul?
You'll get it right one of these days. I'm going to get it.
Well, in my mind, it is right. I mean, look, if you go up on, if you go each week to Gene Marie's podcast, The Long Island Library, somewhere along the way, once you cross into Nassau and Suffolk County, the R is gone and it's the, it is the Long Island Library. So, you know, I take it from where it comes, but Wade, it's good to have you back. I know you've been busy on our one of our CMS contracts. You're project managing one of our CMS contracts, and I know that that's taking a lot of time. So it's good to have you back, get your insights on a few things. And of course, Matt has been slogging through listening to my terrible jokes, my nonsense, my hyperbole, and other and various forms of shenanigans. So it's good to have the team back. And you know, so a press release came out the other day. I was thinking about for this week's episode, we were going to get back and talk about some operational things. A press release came out the other day, and you know, June 15th it came out, and I kind of lost my mind a little bit. Provider in Ohio sentenced to 5 years probation for about $1 million in fraud. Criminally had pled guilty, and it's, you know, wash, rinse, repeat. Same circus, different clowns. She was working for a telemedicine company, authorizing a DME and genetic testing for patients in which there was no medical necessity for it, about $1 million in just shy of restitution. But I guess what I lost my mind about was this case was touted as being part of the National Fraud Initiative that just started, and the provider got 5 years probation. So the question of does crime pay? Maybe, right? The question is maybe, but 5 years probation, $1 million in fraud. The U.S. sentencing guidelines, I haven't done the calculations on it. You know, my first life before I was an OIG agent, I was a federal probation parole officer and I did pre-sentence investigation. So I know the sentencing guidelines very well, or at least I did. But, you know, I think just at first blush that $1 million of fraud, you're probably talking about a 12 to 18 month sentence, maybe even 18 to 24 months. But, you know, 5 years probation, it kind of gets you a little frustrated. And I know we could all kind of relate to cases where we thought that the fraud was more substantial. We know that oftentimes white collar criminals and healthcare fraud fraudsters are sometimes treated differently, you know, in the courts, and seeing 5 years of probation. Now, again, this is a press release, right, guys? So we don't know what the backstory was. We don't know why the judge gave 5 years probation. We don't know if this provider had some health issue that was a mitigating factor or what have you. But you know, when courts sentence, they have to take into consideration what are known as the 3553 factors, which are the factors for things like deterrence, retribution. You know, how do you make amends to the people being the taxpayers for the things that have been done. And so, you know, you see 5 years probation and it's frustrating. And I know as an agent, we would see these kinds of cases where we didn't think that providers were, the restitution was the right amount. We didn't necessarily think that the sentence was the right amount. But certainly what we see in our SIU investigations is it's even more frustrating because you're not seeing things until kind of the end. And then you have to move on. And I know, Wade, we've talked a lot about this. And I know, you know, we say that, you know, you have to keep that positive attitude. And, you know, here at, you've been here now almost as long as me, right? You've been here, you know, 5 years or so, and you've been on a number of teams. You've seen a lot of that frustration come in from a lot of different angles. And the biggest challenge in the SIU space, which is different than being an agent, because as an agent, we're kind of in the weeds and things, and we kind of see, we see these things coming. We already kind of know where this is going to land. In the SIU space, oftentimes you don't know until you get a phone call from the investigator in the law enforcement space or whatever, saying, hey, just letting you know this provider pleaded guilty or they got sentenced or whatever it is. But the hardest part in these cases is just moving on and getting over it, and not letting that frustration get. And as an SIU investigator, and then even as someone who's managing people now, the very difficult piece is not just the motivation to keep people moving on, but it's that constant having to level set expectations. You did your job, you've met the requirements of your job, you did what you can do, and it's not your problem anymore. And where that case lands and where that resolution lands is not the investigator's responsibility anymore. And so talk a little bit from that leadership perspective is keeping the investigators not just motivated to keep doing their job, but how do you constantly keep people in that kind of level setting mode?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is the takeaway is some things are out of your control. You know, worry about things you can change, things that you can't change. Don't waste any energy on it because you can't change it. You know, as far as investigators, you know, doing their job, as long as they're following, you know, standard procedures, they're following best practices, you know, the typical things you want to see them do, running down all the leads, you know, maybe going the extra mile, thinking outside of the box, all these kind of things to push a case forward. You know, you have to keep up on new, you know, updated regs and statutes. You want to network with your peers to make sure that you're getting other, you know, input and ideas. But then once you present the case, as it may be for SIUs to the state or whoever, another agency, you present it, you give them all your work that you've done. And at that point, you're handing it over and it's really out of your hands. There may be some follow-up, you know, trial support or something. They may need more information from you. But at that point, when you've referred it, your work is really done on it. And what happens to that in most cases, you probably won't even hear back. But if you do get, if the case does progress and it's not an outcome that you expected, it might be either declined from the state, you know, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit or whoever you've referred it to, they may sit on it for a while and then just say, we're not interested. So you're thinking all this work I did is for nothing. Or maybe they do go forward and they get a not guilty plea or an unexpected sentence or, you know, minimal restitution, just not what you were expecting from the case. It's out of your hands at that point. There's nothing you can do about it. So you can't let it really affect you. And as far as the management side of it, you know, generally it's all about the stats, right? But in a case like this, you may have a lot of resources invested and you're going to get no stats out of it. As long as the normal, you know, you follow along supervising the case, the normal case progression, you know, support the investigators with resources and, you know, guidance on the case, do routine case reviews. And if the case is properly worked, all those steps are followed. And again, if the outcome is something that wasn't what you had hoped for or projected, sentencing is not what you were expecting, any of those situations, you can't really penalize the investigator because they've done their work. They did what is expected of them. They did all that they could to push the case forward. And there may be situations where they do the work and, you know, we're supposed to be finders of fact, right? So maybe the fact is that they really didn't break this law, this regulation. So again, all these resources invested and you get nothing out of it. But the critique of the investigator, whether it be a yearly, you know, review or just the review that of their work that they get, should not suffer because the outcome is not what you expected, because again, it's out of their control. So you should reward the work that they've done, give recognition for the work, not necessarily just what the outcome is. It's like a cherry on top when you get this great you know, conviction or recovery, that's great. But if you don't, you still have to recognize the work that was done and, you know, critique and, you know, give credit where credit is due because of the work that was done, not necessarily the outcome.
And I think some of the challenge is that people immediately equate results, meaning a restitution or recovery, to work effort or to recognition. And those may be independent of each other, right? So, you know, in some regards, results are the only thing that matter. versus effort, right? If you're in sales or business development, efforts don't matter. It's results. It's the awarding of a contract. It's the signing of a contract. It's money in the door, right? But in the investigative space, it's not always that. It's the effort and keeping them. And so, Matt, you know, part of this then also becomes that people outside of payment integrity may have an expectation, right? The CFO of a payer might say, we're expecting an 8-to-1 return on investment or ROI, when that's not really practical. And so there has to be this level setting when the case is kind of progressing internally and there's case reviews and then leadership is reporting to its leadership. And then the C-suite sees that the SIU is working on $1 billion worth of fraud, I'm not making up a number, right? $1 billion in FWA cases. And then when you go back 6 months later, you find you've only recovered, you know, a percentage of that. And the C-suite then comes back and says, well, Matt Kuchansky, you are the director of payment integrity. You identified in this slide 6 months ago, $1 billion in potential FWA. And I hate when they say exposure, right? And they call exposure the cumulative billings of that provider for that code, which is never really the exposure. The exposure is what we believe to be the percentage of that code that's fraudulent if it's less than 100. But it's sometimes it's a combination of education, level setting, expectations, and then addressing those anomalies or those disparate numbers when it comes about.
It goes toward what Wade was saying about things out of your control. But the first step is setting those expectations. If you're sending something to the C-suite that's identifying every dollar at risk as the potential recovery, that's a misnomer that's going to cause those types of conversations at the end. You promised X and you're giving me X minus 40% or whatever that is. You've got to explain that potential funds at risk does not equal recovery. There's so many factors in the meantime, you know, namely you do a medical review and it's a 70% error rate, not 100%. So that's going to lower it. You've got to be able to define these terms to the C-suite so that they understand that this is what's potentially out there. Here is our estimated, you know, guesstimate on what we might recover from this based on the facts. And some of those variables are, you know, in any type of settlement, there's going to be discussion back and forth between the provider and you that you have to take into account what their side of the story is, how you want to treat that provider. You know, do you want them out of the program? Do you want to abrade them or not? You've got to take that into account in the settlements. There's the potential of litigation risk where we, you know, you just mentioned the not guilty pleas. The, you know, it could be that if you send it to court, you're going to get nothing back. So you're going to want to settle this thing internally so at least you get something. And then there's, you know, also the provider's ability to pay. You know, if you set it up that you want an immediate payback or you set up an offset, you've got to do it against their billings and, you know, they just might stop billing and then you see nothing. So it's best to work within the matrix of, you know, this is what we could possibly get if we get every dollar, but here's what we should, you know, go for. To be realistic and actually bring something back in rather than risk losing it all.
And right. I mean, I think that, you know, the challenge that we find in the payment integrity space is you've got these issues of provider abrasion, first of all, which was a foreign term to the three of us for sure.
It was right? a goal I mean, for us. What do you mean? We wanted them out.
Right. And I would always jokingly say that provider abrasion was how tight are the handcuffs? Because that was really kind of the theory, right? Like, you know, when you really think about it to a large extent, we didn't care if a provider was angry at us for requesting 100 records or if their lawyer complained or whatever the issue was. This was a little bit, you know, this was different. Whereas here, there's that balance between how the plan is going to operate from a business perspective, whether it's for profit or not for profit, what their network of providers is, right? Because at the end of the process, if the provider is really feeling a lot of abrasion, they're going to say, you know, Avita Zane, I don't need to deal with this nonsense.
They're going to take members with them.
Right. And they take members, right. They take members with them. I mean, it's a little bit like the, you know, why is it that suburban doctors in affluent communities don't take Medicaid? Because if they can have a room of commercial paying patients where the average reimbursement is 3x or 4x of Medicaid, what would you rather have in your office, right? You know, would you rather have a room of people where you're going to get $50, or would you rather have a room of people where you're going to get $300? And so a little bit of that is, you know, the more that the provider feels that abrasion, the more that they're going to be annoyed and push back and that. So, you know, that's a factor. And this whole premise of ability to pay, you know, we would think in the OIG terms of, you know, substitute assets, financial litigation, financial disclosures on all of that, where here it's, well, you took this money, where is it, you know, and having to deal with that. And I think that becomes the biggest challenge for us on that one side is the provider abrasion piece. The other part is, how do you placate, and placate's maybe not the right word, but how do you create this understanding to the higher C-suite on these pieces of the puzzle? You know, I've always said that the SIU and payment integrity is kind of like Mikey from the old Life cereal commercials. They were kind of, you know, give it to Mikey, he'll eat it, he'll eat anything, right? When people don't know where to go or they don't have an answer to something, they often go to the SIU or the payment integrity team, right? I mean, we see when we do our SIU scorecards, we see that SIUs have cases open on a variety of things that they should never have open, because they don't know what to do with it. So they open it and they try to slog through to fix the problem when it's a problem that the SIU can't fix or deal with. You know, one great example is identity theft. SIU shouldn't be working identity theft cases, but we see SIUs having inventories of identity theft cases in which they really have nothing to do with an SIU or payment integrity related issue. It's a, you know, it's something that needs to be done through member enrollment or something. It's not really an SIU case, but you know, that becomes, I think, a lot of the challenge is, you know, where you get to that middle ground. Now, kind of bringing us back to this case, you know, this case is reminiscent of all the cases that we see. Genetic testing, DME, right? Obviously, one of the big issues is that in the DME space, a face-to-face needs to be done. This person's in Ohio. This doc is in Ohio. The telemedicine company was in Georgia. The press release discusses that the provider was essentially clicking, you know, waiting for the workman's comp for carpal tunnel to be filed. And we see this all the time. And so it's really more of a broader problem on the timely filing of claims. And I know we've addressed this a million times. And Matt and I, you and I have had ad nauseum conversations about the disparity in that because of the 12-month filing that providers have and the lack of ability to match up. But of course, it still gets to the same premise of, from a data analytics perspective, this provider's in Ohio, telemedicine company was in Georgia, they were likely soliciting people in geographic areas outside of where this doctor existed, and they were likely submitting claims for these items and services that were from where this doctor had no prior history whatsoever. So there's a whole slew of other kind of collective issues, but you know, I think it's important for people to know that once you've done your job on this case, if you're an SIU and you're working on this case, once you've done what you can do, you have to just move on. And recognition is different than the result of the stat. There may be things that you have no control over. If you settle a case for 50% or 60% on the dollar, if it was $1 million and identified FWA, and the case settled for $500,000, that's not in the investigator's control, right? That's what ultimately the result is from a variety of things. And I think it's very important that people in leadership and management be in a position to recognize the hard work, the value of that case, and be prepared to recognize people, however that's done, whether it be through newsletters, recognition awards, if there's a bonus pool for certain things like that, whatever that recognition results in, that recognition is not the same as results in those cases. And you know, from a manager's perspective, Wade, it's just being able to ensure that people readily recognize that that's the case. And from a C-suite, like high end, it's kind of that level setting, right, Matt? That, you know, sometimes the people that are on the in the C-suite may not even understand what the payment integrity people go through on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Yeah, and you can look to things like, you know, if it is a $500,000 settlement on $1 million exposure, what, you know, what is the provider's conduct after that? Did they improve the way they do their billing? Did they lessen the amount so that there's this indirect savings because of the effort that was put into that first case? Those things have to be taken into consideration as well. You know, I've always advocated for different types of KPIs and performance evaluations for SIUs. Get away from the how much money did you bring back? How, you know, how many cases did you open? How many leads did you open? It's got to be more quality driven for them to be really realistic and
right
in terms of what the true performance of the SIU is.
Right. And that's great. And Wade, as we wrap up, the question that always gets asked is, what's the right number of cases that an investigator should have? And my position is that's an intangible. It's impossible, right? As we kind of wrap up, Wade, when you're thinking about what that right number is, what are some of the things that you take into consideration from an investigator's, you know, from an assignment perspective? What are some of the things that you have to keep in mind?
Well, I think the key things are the complexity of the case. Somebody might have, I've heard of some case numbers of cases that people are trying to work is, in my opinion, just ridiculous. 60, 80 cases, that's just impossible in my opinion, no matter how easy they are. But you have to consider that one very complex case may be perfect for somebody because of the resources that it's going to take, as opposed to someone who's working 10 or 12 cases. So the complexity of the case is probably the key factor. And I think the second factor is the not only the experience of the investigator, because you may have someone that, who's very experienced, but their skill set maybe is limited to a smaller number of cases. Again, taking the complexity into consideration.
Somebody might have only worked podiatry cases their entire career.
So those are the two keys, I think. But also, I mean, the complexity of them, the experience, and kind of what the expectation of the SIU management is. Are we looking for, we've talked about this many times, do we care about referrals? Do we only care about ROI? What are we looking for? And that again goes back to the investigator's experience. Maybe they're not used to working cases where a referral is like, there's no interest in referrals. And if that's the case, make sure that they know that. But I think those are really the three key things: the complexity, the experience, and the type of resolution that the management is looking for.
Yeah, great. And you know, and you've said this many times, and this is actually, I think, kind of associated with the complexity, is that a case that's $1 million could take as long as a case that's $100,000. A $100,000 case could take more time. If you have a $100,000 case on, it's one aberrant bill for a surgery versus $1 million in E&Ms, right? Those two cases, vastly different dollar amounts, vastly different fact patterns, but they could take the same amount of time. And so that, you know, that becomes part of that challenge also in what is that right number? I don't know. There is no right number. And I think that that's the thing. We get asked quite often, what's the right number of cases? And you have to take those different factors into consideration. I would say a complex case that involves multiple codes or a new code in which there's no track record is going to be, if we're scoring case complexity and things of that sort, obviously in an E&M upcoding case, I would score on a 1 to 5. I would say that's a 1 or a 2 in complexity, but volume is going to increase the time. But if you have $1 million case in which you're talking about a new code, a complex code, a complex surgery, I would say that that's going to have potentially a higher weighted score in that complexity. That's going to create a, you know, a whole other set of challenges.
And that's why a team leader manager, that's why their jobs are so important. They have to be able to gauge what the right workload is for each of their investigators based on their performance. You know, are they able to get through the workload in a quality manner, in a timely manner? That means that their workload is right for them. If it's not, then you've got to change it. And that's a constant piece of management that this team lead has to do.
Right.
I think too, Matt, we had worked on some things together on a recent contract where the use of data analytics can make a huge difference too. If you can run an algorithm and say these two codes should never be billed together, and then you run the data and you have, you know, X amount of times this has happened, that's a pretty easy, that could be a very short case where you go to the provider and say, this should have never been built that way. The exposure, again, we say is X amount, and, you know, we'll consider, you know, settling for 70% of that because these should have, there's no question these two codes should have never been built together. So the second code is all, whether it's fraud or waste, maybe it wasn't intentional, but it should not have been paid. So that type of case takes like almost no time as compared to you're doing interviews, you're doing surveillance, you're doing all these other things. So that's another, like the fourth category.
And maybe those are the cases that you settle, you don't go to 50%. Maybe you say, we're not settling for less than 70%. Those are cases that we would typically call strict liability. Here's the policy. The policy says this, you violated the policy, medical necessity, medical record review. It doesn't even matter. You know, as we kind of wrap up, I worked on something a couple of years ago where there was a policy involving facet joint injections. And the policy was you cannot bill more than five in a rolling 12-month period for a patient. Anything more than five, you shouldn't be paid for. Problem was the edit in place wasn't good. Claims got through. But at the end, there were no, you know, as part of the resolution, there were no medical records to review. It was data. It was data, and it was, this is the number. We're not vacillating off of this number. Pay it or don't pay it, but this is what we're doing. And I think, you know, and you have to, that does come in that weighing of that scoring. And that's where you really need to be able to incorporate your auditing staff, your payment integrity people, because they're going to help you navigate. This is black and white. The policy says this, they did that. And then that's going to add into that complexity and that. So, you know, look, you got to keep working these cases. And as much as it's hard sometimes to stay motivated to do the work, because there are going to be wins and losses. And I think, unfortunately, in our space, you have more losses than wins. And by losses, I mean cases that just never go anywhere, or they settle for a dollar amount that you think is lower than what it should be. So it's not that it's a loss in that sense, but it's not to the resolution that everybody expects. I think, level setting expectations is always the biggest challenge, and staying motivated to just keep doing the work and know that you did the best you can is really where it is. So good conversation. Again, you know, I was frustrated at a five-year probation for $1 million. And, but we don't know a lot of the other facts. So there may have been a lot of other facts, but you just see from the press release, it's like, you know, $1 million gets you 5 years probation. Then you see other instances where people are doing $2 million or the same $1 million, and they're getting 2 years in jail and supervised release and all this other stuff. So there may be other parts of the story we don't know, and that's fine. We're just kind of talking about what we see in front of us. And part of that ultimately in those 3553 factors becomes deterrence. Does this serve to provide general and specific deterrence? Specific deterrence, I would say yes. This provider is probably never going to do this again. But general deterrence, you know, we see these cases all the time. We see the same circus, different clowns, wash, rinse, repeat. And so is there really a deterrence? So, but you just got to stay the course. You got to just stay with it. So good conversation, guys. Wade, welcome back. At least, you know, while you're able to make these when our other work isn't taking you away. Matt clearly is under assigned because he's always available for these. So we're going to have to see what we can do about that. So as always, look, we've got a lot of LinkedIn Live scheduled. You're going to start seeing some more stuff. We've got months and months of them already planned. So you're going to start seeing those on our LinkedIn page. And again, the newsletter comes every week to your inbox. Just go up under our website, advisehealth.com, and you can see about getting the newsletter. And of course, our weekly OIG roundtables are available on Spotify, on YouTube. Just subscribe to the Advise Health channel and you'll get each one of our weekly ones. So as always, we appreciate you spending your time and we'll see you on the next OIG roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.